Tonight, the talk is on surrender, but I want to get off the topic to begin with. And I just got a sense, and as I was watching people come in, that they were bringing a lot of their day in with them, which, of course, most of us do. We carry it with us. And it dawned on me that if you do that for too long, the practice can't find its way through the thickness of our attitude, of our disposition. It can't penetrate, the sun can't penetrate the clouds of our covering. And how important it is to have persistence, because we're all going to have days in which the cloud layer is very thick. And that can, especially for new people, but even for people who are long practiced, if those clouds go on for very long, it gets discouraging. It just feels like your day is nothing but the darkness through which we see. And it can get very morose. It can create an attitude about the practice from the attitude that we carry about the day. And those two can rub off on each other, and that it's only through consistent and persistent sitting, coming and just doing it, whether you like it or not, whether it's enjoyable or not, has really nothing to do with the persistence that's needed. It needs your consistency, because that's the only way we can break out of this. We can break the hold that the attitude can freeze us within. And, you know, it's I'm not trying to get people to come to this Sangha so much as trying just to get you to express your life as lived in the Dharma. And that it needs your force of intention to do that. It needs your persistence, your force of intention, and just your everyday coming. Your practice at home, of course, is the most important thing, and then connecting with each other throughout the week, and then coming here if you so wish. But it can fade very quickly, no matter how experienced we may seem, unless we offer it that kind of reinforcement. So I just want to encourage that for people. The other point I wanted to make was how I started the meditation, was that as our lives get kind of encrusted with an attitude, and we often, and we sit within that attitude, we just have a communication from that attitude about our life. Really, very little else is seen. It can be a very negative, contracted picture of our life, and we just sit there and meditate, and then the attitude does the meditation. It does the thinking for us, it does the reinforcement, it does the feeling, and we just sit there and reinforce that thing. Now, we need to be stronger than that. We need to break out of this thing. You're not going to break out of it if you just bring to it what is there. You have to be quieter than that in yourself. You have to see that there's more to your life than what the mind is offering you in any particular time. And that requires not a forced intention, it requires a receptivity, a sensitivity, a willingness to feel what is there with an ever-increased sensitivity of heart, so that what is there affects you, you feel what you're carrying. You don't just speak and narrate from what you're carrying, but you actually feel the emotions. You begin to let it touch us and let it in. That sense of being porous to the experiences of life means that we won't be taking those experiences with the same degree of confirmation that we give when we don't and when we aren't as that sensitive, when we just think our way through our daily life and through our attitudes. So that sense of being willing to receive what is there without fear, no matter what the emotion or no matter what how we're confiscating the moment, how we're controlling the moment, how we're containing it, doesn't matter. Just to feel what's there and feel it and really let it rub up against us. That's how wisdom, that's the access door. That's the way we access wisdom. We don't access wisdom by thinking about our attitudes or by just perpetuating the storyline that we have been living all day long. We access wisdom by allowing that in to a different perception, within a different perception, so that we're not being carried away or flooded by the emotion, but rather we're seeing it or sensing it as just one aspect of consciousness, not the whole of consciousness. And so the door of surrender, which is tonight's talk, is very much that door of sensitivity, of allowance, of the subtlety of allowing things to be thoroughly understood. How will we ever release something, which is what surrender means? How would we ever surrender or just drop our defenses unless we are absolutely sure that the experience itself wouldn't ruin us? And we're never going to get that confirmation, that courage, that fearlessness that is faith, until we understand that it won't ruin us. But there comes a point before we know that fact that we drop our guard. And that's the surrender that is confirmed through faith and wisdom. Now, when I talk about surrender, it's a very testy word. It carries a lot of baggage. So let me define it very clearly for you so that you know where we're going with this thing. The first thing surrender often brings up for us is sort of the white flag attitude of our lives. I can't do this, deal with this anymore, I give up. That sort of, you know, if there's a battle to be won, I just lost it. And actually, there's a point in which surrender does play in that way, because in some ways we have to lose the battle to win the war, you might say. And what I mean by that is, as we try to apply different ways of working with an experience that all have a slight edge of aversion to the way we're working, we're trying to let it be, you know, but we're not really letting it be. We're just trying to contain it so it doesn't get worse. We're trying to remind us that it's going to pass, and, you know, if we can just stay our seat long enough, this too shall pass, but that's aversion as well. So we have a whole bag of tricks that are very slightly aversive. And after we've played all those out, because we don't win from any of those, all we do is invest a different aversion into the very experience we're trying to surrender to. So in some ways, we have to lose the battle of our strategies. We have to just sort of, well, nothing's working here. And then you actually, what happens when you make that statement psychically, not just intellectually, you drop your guard. Dropping your guard is surrender. Having no defense, that's what surrender is. Right? That's the white flag. Okay, I can't do this. It's not from doubt or from a sense of failure. It's like, I don't have any other choices here. I've tried everything in my power to diminish the intensity of this experience, this pain, or whatever it is, and now I have nothing left. So I'll offer it nothing and see what happens there. And in that dropping of the guard, the experience is allowed in. And when it's allowed in a complete non-resistant way, that loses everything it ever held against you. Everything it ever held in contempt, you held it in contempt, was what you invested in it, the words you offered it, the fear you had of it. And when you drop your guard, you obviously don't have any more fear of it. You just, that's it. It's like, okay, so it's you and me, you know? And then it's not the same anymore. Never, it never can arise with the same fervor that it used to. I'm sure many of you have had that experience before, but really then what we mean by surrender is we're surrendering the separation between ourselves and that experience. So what is it that we surrender, you see? And this is often misunderstood. You think you can go to the pain and you just kind of be with the pain. And the pain will change, and the pain will change to something else. And you can say, oh, you know, I let go of that. What did you let go of? It just changed on you, you know. And if when it comes back in a different form, you will be contesting it again. So there was no conclusion to that. What we surrender is what we're saying about it. That's what we're surrendering. We're surrendering the very narrative, the very invested way that we give it credibility through our words, through what we have known about it in the past, through our memory relationship with it. And if we give that up, that's all it contains. All it contains is what we remember it to contain. But that's a very strong coding. And so, but you can see it. That's the, when you allow it in, that you can feel the coding. You can feel what you've given it. You can feel the words that you've intoned in it. It's like, but you have to, when we don't let it in, when we try to hold it out, we're not listening to the words we've given it. We believe the words we've given it, and that's the fear response we have of it. We fear the words we've given it. That's what we are afraid of. But once we just let it in, once it touches us and affects us, we see it from a different light, and the words fall away, and then so does the sense of separation from it. So tonight's talk is a little bit more subtle than the fundamental talks that I've had up until here, but you see, I want to encourage you into this subtlety and not get discouraged because your practice isn't showing you that, but encourage you forward on this. It's within everybody's reach to be able to understand this. Now, let me talk about the opposite, or the alternative, I should say, to surrender, which is adaptation. And I want to just talk a little bit about it from a historical point of view, if I could, because adaptation is what is kind of genetically in us to do. Some 3.8 billion years ago, life began, as I've often mentioned in this class, began with a single cell's aliveness, one cell, once. Not 100 times all over the planet, but once. And that single cell then divided and divided again. And as its environment changed within those divisions, it adapted to the environmental changes and to whatever pressures or stressors were on that organism, that single cell organism, as it multiplied across the sea, I guess, is where it was in the beginning. And so it grew into all of the vegetable and animal life that we know today. And we know that because you can look at the DNA of grass and it contains 50% of the DNA of the human cell. So scientists then know that grass at some point crossed with us. So it's all brother and sisters out here, right? But the point is that we learned how to adapt through change of environments. The environment would change, and then the genetics would change in order to make us, allow us to master that environment. And so the species survived through its ability to adapt. So it's a very strong genetic tendency in us for adaptation, but there's a counter influence on adaptation, because if you look at the human species and you just look at that species alone, you'll see us in every corner of the world. You'll see us in deserts and you'll see us in Antarctica. You'll see us living in the most desolate areas and in the most populated areas and then at 20,000 feet and at sea level. And everywhere that the human being has adapted, has gone, it's adapted to that climate and to those conditions. So at some point, that adaptation becomes our comfort level, right? And then when it becomes our comfort level, it becomes our home. And then when it becomes our home, it's where we belong, right? Now, you will fight for where you belong. As a species, we've proven that. Even if it's a chunk of ice somewhere, or a cave, doesn't matter. It's our comfort level. And what we're really fighting is that we don't want to change anymore. We want to arrest the adaptation and stay where we are because we've adapted to this comfort level and we want everyone else out and away from us. So it allows our comfort level to sustain itself. And this sense of belonging is driving that. I think once we get to a place of comfort and we can claim ownership of it, there's something very intrinsic in our systems that want to belong. And we then ascribe the sense of belonging to the environmental conditions that we are in. And then that allows us to have a sense of purpose and territory and all of that. So the sense of adaptation is extraordinarily important, and it is something that has been driving us all along, and we can certainly see it externally. But can we see it internally? So let me take you into the internal belongings that we have, the internal home and comfort range that we have set up for ourselves, because there too we will find where we will defend. Remembering that in the external level, our environment, we will defend it because it's our home, it's where we belong, it's our comfort level. So to our internal environment, meaning our self-image, listen carefully, our self-images, our opinions, our conclusions, our attitude in the story in which we embrace life, what we hold life to be, and our place within it, is we have, throughout the course of our life, we have reasons to have formed this story. And it's a very vital part of the sense of being at home in ourselves is the familiarity, may not be a pleasant one, may be full of drama or pain or tension, but it's just like if you lived in an igloo. The tension of trying to get up every day in sub-zero weather probably pales by the tension that we get up given some of the attitudes that we carry with us as our own. And yet it's ours. And so we will defend it. And we do defend it from change, from any more adaptation. And we will fight that. If and when we see someone especially attacking our image or even questioning our attitude, we will react from that attitude in defense of the righteousness we feel in having that attitude and what we see in life that proves the attitude to be correct. Get a sense of that in ourselves. Get a sense of the way we have adapted. It's as if you took something very innocent called you when you were born, dragged you and I through a number of experiences, and scar tissue grew from the scrapes and bumps and torn areas of all of the input that we've had over the years. And then from that innocence, that kind of shell of scarring, created the hardness that most of us know ourselves by, and the defenses and the reactions through which we now relate to the world. And that becomes our home. That becomes what's familiar to us. That becomes our sense of belonging. That's how I know myself. That's every bit as important as living in the area that you live in which you call that physical environment your home. Now, we have to be careful here, because every once in a while, through a little bit of observation, some Dharma gets through and shows us that the attitude we carry isn't very helpful to us or others. In fact, you can see a line of bodies that have lived through our attitude and our reaction. And we think to ourselves, okay, I've got to change that. Right? I've got to change this. And we say, okay, you know, I don't want to change it because it means an adaptation response to a place that I feel comfortably at home. But I see the difficulty it's creating, and so I need to change it. Now, it's very important, and this is where the subtlety that I want to bring out tonight. Changing your attitude, okay, certainly has its positive effect upon your life. There's no question. You can alter how you see things, and we get very clever dharmically, very clever. Because after a while, in a few years, when you've looked at your mind and you understand the nature of thought, you realize that you can intrude upon the way thought thinks, that you can turn it to your benefit rather than have it turn against you. And so we start with our knobs and we start twisting a little bit and changing the nature of our thinking. And we learn that you can release unskillful thoughts and encourage skillful ones, and that you can build this thing up through adaptation. And it can be very helpful. I'm not at all suggesting that it's not. Very important in setting us up so that we handle the challenges that are coming to us from a very different disposition than we did when we were all reactive. And believe it or not, our family likes us better. And others begin to encourage us to meditate more. And it's all working very well. Okay? That's equivalent to behavior modification. Just stay with me here. I'm not suggesting it doesn't have a place. I'm suggesting the place it does have is limited. All right? Now, when you come here, I'm going to give you the unlimited. If you want me to give you the limited, I will do it in perspective of the unlimited. So I've given you the limited, but it's limited. And why is it limited? Because it's an adaptation of the narrative of what we're saying to ourselves. The narrative hasn't ceased. We've just changed the story. We've been able to uproot what we say to ourselves. We've been able to change the configuration so that instead of hostility, we receive it, we allow it, we do whatever we want to that's more accepting. And we have a very wonderful life that is much richer, much more pleasant, much greater happiness. It's equivalent to when you change your attitude and just see life from a different point of view, it's equivalent of seeing the glass half full rather than half empty. You can train yourself not to be pessimistic. Okay, you know, given my tendencies, I always look at the dark side. Well, I can train myself to feel that tendency to look at the dark side and encourage a different optimism. But that's just seeing the glass from a different narrative, from a different storyline. It's really, you know, the power of positive thinking. Which is fine. I mean, it's had its day in our culture. But dharmic understanding is different. You see, we're not interested in just perpetuating a new story. We're interested in something else. But let me just play with this a little more, because most of us, as we begin to practice, begin to sense or get a feeling for some of the fundamental truths about experience that are very helpful, like impermanence, right? It's very helpful to have that realization of impermanence. When you realize that something's impermanent, you don't try to push, you don't get quite as upset when tragedies happen. You don't try to keep everything new all the time, because you know that's not the way life is. And so, what is it that's happening internally once we've really experienced something, the truth of impermanence? Well, what happens is that we change our narrative about life so that it now includes the truth of impermanence, right? So I have a pain, and I say, okay, so this too shall pass. Won't last that long, just stay the course. Just be patient. You know, this is going to end, or whatever we do. So we take that truth that's intrinsic characteristic of life, and we build a story around that truth, which keeps that truth sort of encouraged out front, but it's in an intellectual component. It's an intellectual focus on life. We're not really letting life in anymore. We're keeping a buffer of this truth between ourselves and life. You see that? This too shall pass. And if I just wait long enough, it will, as bad as it's getting. Okay, so I can handle that. So being with things as they are is not simply adjusting our mindset about the way things are. Okay? So I should be touching nerves here. Dharmic nerves. I like to touch nerves because it shows where we have adapted a home, where we have settled on the Dharma as being the way it's going to be for me. And there is no way to settle on the Dharma so that it feeds you continuously, unless any place that you settle on the Dharma will come back and bite you. The Buddha said, if you hold the Dharma fixed, it's like picking up the tail of a poisonous snake. You see, this thing has to be in movement. It can't be fixed. The words fix it, the ideas fix it, the narrative that we offer life fixes it. It gives us a home. It gives us, we've adapted now, you know. Leave me alone. I've got a home now. I've said the Dharma home. And you want, what is the Dharma home? Well, I'll tell you what the Dharma home. The Dharma home is all things are impermanent. That's wise. Yeah, I got more too. I can give you. It's a fixed response. Yes, it's in line with the truth of reality, but it's buffered by the narrative about that reality, not an interface with that reality. And the way you know an adaptive response is very interesting as you start looking at this thing, is that it won't be forever true. This thing, it may not pass, it may not, you know, it too shall pass, but it's not passing at the speed I want it to pass. So there's a tension with that truth. Anytime it's in a fixed adaptive response, you're going to have a grief reaction when you have to readapt a new message or change or alter that adaptive response so that it fits more completely into the form that the reality is taking. And a grief response, for those of you who might have forgotten, include denial. I'll tell you, look at the current climate crisis and you'll see a grief response. Now, some of us went right to acceptance. You know, it didn't take a lot of alteration. We knew what it meant. It was going to be a different life that we would all have to live. But we also knew what would happen if we didn't accept this perspective, and that it would come back and be torturous, more for our children and our children's children than for us, but it would be torturous nevertheless. But that's us. There's layers and layers of different resistance to that truth. Denial, you can't ask for a better example of denial than about climate change, right? So then, what's the next one? Denial, anger. Anger, you can certainly sense that in this sense of the grief response to climate change. Here's the one I like, though, bargaining. Okay, this is the consensus view is now shifting a little bit to bargaining, which is good because it's getting closer to acceptance, but it's still years and years away. Meanwhile, the clock is ticking, but never mind. The bargaining goes something like this. Okay, the climate is changing, right? Yes, it's 115 degrees in Chillicothe, Ohio. It's never been that hot, ever. The climate is changing, but the climate's changed in the past. It's just a spike. You know, this isn't the real, this isn't human-made. We'll just move with this spike, and then in a few years, the spike will be gone, right? That's bargaining, okay? So that's also delay tactic. And then, of course, we haven't seen much depression because we haven't come to that. But at some point, we will have to really look at our lives and see what we're giving up and what we have to give up. I'm sure there'll be a high spike in Prozac at that point. And then acceptance, where let's just get on with this thing and start making it meaningful. In any case, the point is that the grief response is always appropriate in an adaptive change. Okay, when you're changing from something to something else, there's going to be a grief response. And those stages of grief, sometimes they don't last very long, but often you can see the movement through those changes of grief. That is not true for surrender. There's no grief response to surrender because the narrative is finished. What's happening in a grief response is that we're changing the narrative. We don't want to give the narrative up. We don't want to stop talking about how badly we need to belong and have this house that we have that's burning down. So we change the narrative very slowly so that we partially give it up with each stage of grief until it starts out like this with denial and it ends up like that, in accordance with acceptance. Surrender has no time element. It's a maturation of wisdom. I spoke about faith the last couple of weeks, and I would just like to talk briefly about how wisdom and faith and surrender all work cooperatively together. Because it's those three. In the beginning, practice is so much force and tension, right? There's a lot of ambivalence and a lot of resistance and a lot of just kind of grinding out an adaptive response so that we can have some response, so we can see, be a little more cheerful than we were when we started this thing. As we work through that resistance, the need to frame everything in terms of adaptive response and the denial and the anger and all going through all those stages and then finally coming to some degree of relaxation given the new environment, we realize we can shorten this course considerably. We realize we can go instantaneously. What it requires is a very mature wisdom. And that maturity of that wisdom has allowed experience to inform it all along the way. We now understand the nature of experience as impermanent in its nature, not as something to talk about. And therefore, to say anything about experience forces it to be something that it never could possibly be, since it's always in transition out of that fixation. And so we shut up. And we allow experience in. We live experience rather than have experience. Now, when we live experience, we are in movement with the experience. We're not adapting to it. We're not setting up a house of belonging that fixates on a particular experience that lasts a little while, like summer in Seattle, when we know what October brings, right? We're in movement with the experience of summer as it's moving into October. Because we're in movement, there is no resistance to October and no memory, which is why I read this poem, of the summer that we bring into October that has us resist October because we wish we were still in August. That's what we give up. We're not talking to ourselves about the nature of life and how wonderful it is, because as soon as we do, it's not wonderful anymore. It's changed to something else. And we realize that all the words do at best is to capture a fleeting memory. Even a moment ago is a fleeting memory. And that's too late and too long ago to bring into this moment. Even a moment, an instant ago. And when we realize that, and there are different ways to realize that, then the resistance to the moment, because when we resist, we're bringing some other memory into this present moment and comparing the two and wishing that we had gone the way of the previous memory instead of the way the reality is taking us, and on, and that's called misery. That's called misery. And if you want to be miserable, we all start off very miserable, but we try to adapt our way out of misery by telling ourselves better stories that allow us to adapt, that have the story of release and impermanence and truth within the storyline, so that we feel really good, because that's what the Buddha said, although we're meeting life still with a story, which is a fixed response to it. Are people following this? That's not a story. That's why we're afraid of awareness, because awareness does not adapt. You see? Have you ever noticed that? When you're sitting and you're aware, the sound, a click, click, click will be going, or some annoying sound. Awareness doesn't adapt to that. It just keeps showing you the click, 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 click. Never adapts. You notice that? See, awareness never adapts. The mind adapts. That's why awareness is not valued for many of us. It's not valuable because it doesn't allow my adaptive response. It keeps showing me what I have to adapt into. It doesn't show me what I want to go. It shows me where I've got to go. It shows me the way the moment is. It doesn't show me the memory of what I really feel precious. You see, when we abide within the memory, we're not abiding in awareness. Awareness doesn't abide in memory. It abides, it's non-adaptive. But it's the only thing you can trust. Because it's the only thing that's real. It's the only thing that's true. It's the only thing that's not thinking itself into the next circumstance. Because it doesn't. It is the circumstance. It is the moment. And you either join it or you have an adaptive response. And so we give up searching for a new explanation for why we have to accommodate awareness, the truth. And after we've gone through a litany of adaptive response, we think, God, this is just crazy. I'm just talking my way into the present. I'm getting closer to it. But I'm still just outside of it. And therefore, there is a residue of pain associated with being outside of the moment, no matter how close to that moment we may become. And that's not good enough for our hearts. This is an all or nothing affair. Let us all join the affair. Can we sit for a minute or two? Now, I want to say, in perspective, that all of us that I know of have used our practice for an adaptive response for probably most of the years that we have been doing it. There's nothing wrong with that. In fact, it's a very important phase of the practice because we learn the value of adaptation because we're getting closer to the moment that we're adapting. We're actually leaving a lot of duration behind, a lot of time behind. We're getting very close to it. It's keeping us very close to it. But at some point, we also feel the limitation of that proximity. It's not quite enough for us. It doesn't quite move fast enough to catch the brilliant light speed of the present. It's just a hair's breadth behind. But it's enough to skew everything. But it's an important step because we learn about the limitation of adaptation by using it, by practicing it. Because that's all we know. As a species, that's all we've learned. Of course we're going to use it. But we see the value, you see what real wisdom is. The wisdom is you're learning all the time about every strategy you're using, including the strategy of your Dharma practice. And that informs us always on why we're doing it, what motivates to do us, and also the limits of us doing it in that way. It's not about following the breath. It's about learning. It's not about holding up somewhere that is a new home for ourselves, where we can be calm, have a calm home and a nice home and a peaceful home. And in the other 24, 23 hours a day, when we're not sitting, harboring ourselves in a safe canyon, we think about how delightful it would be to be on retreat and get away from all this hectic. No, that's not Dharma life. So to know that you're doing that, if you're doing that, to be aware of that, that's all. That's all. Not a right or wrong, just be aware. Okay, what's the value of what I'm doing? What's the limitation of what I'm doing? What's the value? What's the limitation? Okay, all. Any questions or comments? I'd be happy to respond if I can. Yes, sir.
Well, the tension between hanging in there with your adaptive narrative, trying to change something or make something happen, or adapting somewhere, versus the alternative is to surrender. can you say more about what might be indications?
What are the indications that your narrative is not working and you need to surrender? Suffering. Suffering. Okay? What else would be the indicator? When you come in, I was just watching, what drove most of this talk was not what I had planned, was watching the faces of you as you were coming in. And I'm not being impolite, because we all carry that heaviness with us throughout the day. But this is a group of Dharma practitioners, and it really looked like you had just been through your expression of hell. And it just doesn't have to be that way. It doesn't have to be that way. And so if you're finding yourself believing in your state of mind, that's a good indication that you are stuck and fixated within a narrative about that state of mind. Oh God, And the more you talk your way into it, the more the emotion will express itself, because the incentive for the emotion to arise is the talk we give, the self-talk. So as we get deeper into that sense of how awful the day is going, we will feel that much more awful, which will then lead to more of our speaking about how awful it was and is. And if you do that long enough, it becomes how you get out of bed in the morning. It becomes your disposition. It becomes connected and associated with life itself. It becomes reinforced the attitude becomes paired with life, not with the experiences that led to the attitude originally, but with life itself. Let me give you an example. Anxiety. Long since, what caused the anxiety has now been generalized to be anxiety for life, getting up, waking up out of bed. And it just keeps pulling us further and further into that. So how do we arrest this thing, you see? Well, you do, first of all, you realize where you're going, and then changing your talk. And a lot of very poor dharma is around that. But there's also good dharma around changing your talk, learning to hear your talk, not investing in unskillful. When you see your mind, because you're with the increased sensitivity, when you feel your mind getting pulled into the negative, you just release it. Right? That's the serenity. You just, I don't have to go there. And then through metta and other things, you start building a new sense of yourself that has a lightness and a more appreciative tone to it. You know, Ellen and I went to a John Gottman's couple workshop about a few years ago. So it was a whole workshop, cost a lot of money. And basically, this is what he said. Learn to be kind. I mean, he has a whole workbook, and he gives you all the research. He says that within 20 seconds of two people speaking together, he knows whether those two people's relationship is going to last. And he gives you a whole way to come out of that system and that has kept you within the reactive patterns of the other so that you can be kind to that person. First, you have to want to be. But if you want to be, it's right there. You can step right out of it. You can change your narrative. Amazingly effective. Right? So, but it's awareness. It's seeing where our patterns go and being able to release the need to continue to milk those old reactive patterns, seeing the inward pain of our own landscape, of our own psyche, and how they come up, especially in relationship. And just being willing to say, this isn't helpful, it's not working anymore. And at that point, it just stops, it ceases. And you get very quiet. Now, what often comes in is the adaptive response to that quiet, because the quiet doesn't feel fulfilling. It feels quiet. And so you think, okay, now I need to build something else up out of that quiet that somehow gives me a stability of purpose and intention and relationship within it. And then we get lost in the adaptive response, because we still feel the need for to carry ourselves along. At some point, you won't feel the need to carry yourself along. You'll feel that you carrying yourself along is actually a burden, is a weight. And then the adaptive response will fall away. You won't need it anymore. It's within the course of the practice. If you persist and continue, you just won't need yourself anymore. It's an extra. Why carry that around? And you'll do just fine without it. Now, some people say, "Oh, I'm so far from that. I can't." Well, then that's it. You see, you've adapted. Your image won't hold. Your image is so close to self-doubt, it won't hold discouragement, and you'll falter. Why? Because you believe in the state of mind of discouragement. You believe that that's truly who you are. As if a phrase could define you. Others of you somehow will persevere and you'll step out of this one day. And it may be much closer, that day be much closer than you might perceive. Adaptation, changing the storyline, yeah.
Yeah, and couldn't one make the argument that then cultivating, say, loving kindness for oneself is also a form of adaptation?
Yes.
How do you distinguish that? You're saying it
isn't. Is metta a form of adaptation? It can be. It's any skillful means is an adaptation. All skillful means. Metta can be seen as a skillful means in which you are alleviating a burden that if you carried would end your practice very quickly, the burden of self-hatred. You cannot sustain yourself in this practice believing you to be the person you dislike. We got to change that quick. Metta is a good system for changing that around, and it's an adaptive response with a different identity, a different image. Okay, very important. Okay, so that's the skillful. There's also a way in which metta is not a skillful means, but is the surrender itself. If you find self-hatred arising and you don't try to adapt out of that self-hatred, you simply hold that self-hatred in love. That self-hatred cannot continue. It is not an adaptive response, and it falls away. Do you see? It takes a long time to get to that second, because we don't believe in the love that surrounds everything. We believe in the state of mind that tells us there is no love, even though that state of mind is surrounded simultaneously with love. We don't believe that. See? But after a while, you begin to sense it. And then you get very quiet about needing to do anything with the state of mind except be still with it, which is the love. Okay, so enough for tonight. Thank you.